A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The word tachia is a Rorschach test. One person reads it and sees a survival mechanism. Persecuted Shia hiding their faith under Sunni rule to avoid getting killed. Another person reads it and sees a license to lie in negotiations, a theological permission slip for deception. Both sides cite the same Iranica article, and that's the problem.
That tension is exactly why Daniel sent us this prompt. He wants us to look at Taqiyya not in isolation, but as part of a cluster of concepts, Hudna, Jihad, the Dar al-Harb, and Dar al-Islam binary, and how they form a coherent strategic doctrine. The question isn't just what these terms mean. It's how they operate together, and specifically how Iran and militant groups have used them to make real operational decisions.
Daniel's framing is worth sitting with for a second. He's saying these aren't four separate tactics. They're a single grammar. And if you don't understand the grammar, you don't understand the moves. Let's talk about the word that launched 1,000 conspiracy theories and 1,000 actual military strategies.
Let's be upfront about the discomfort here. This episode is going to sound, at points, like it's confirming every Islamophobic stereotype in the book. We're going to sit in that discomfort and show why the reality is both more nuanced and more operationally coherent than either side of that debate usually admits.
The timing matters too. Iran's nuclear program is in a post-2026 breakout phase. Regional ceasefires keep collapsing into rearmament cycles. Understanding the doctrinal framework behind these moves isn't academic. It's operational intelligence for anyone trying to read the next decade of Middle East strategy.
Let's define our terms, because these words don't mean what most people think they mean, and getting them right is the difference between seeing a system and seeing noise.
Start with tachya. What's the actual definition, stripped of the internet baggage?
The Iranica article is the authoritative source. Tachya is permissible dissimulation, concealing or misrepresenting your beliefs to protect yourself or your community from persecution. It originated as a specifically Shia doctrine, developed over centuries because Shia minorities lived under Sunni rule where openly professing their faith could get them killed. The key word is permissible. It's a dispensation, not a commandment.
It starts as a survival mechanism. Don't get murdered for being the wrong kind of Muslim.
But it evolved. The mechanism isn't simply lying is allowed. It's that truth is contextual and intent matters more than words. If your intention is to protect the faith or achieve a strategic end that serves the community, what you say is judged by that intent, not by surface-level factual accuracy.
Which is a much more slippery concept than Muslims are allowed to lie. That's the crude caricature, and it's wrong. But the sophisticated version is almost harder to deal with, because it's harder to pin down.
Britannica is clear. In classical Islamic jurisprudence, a hudna is a temporary truce, permissible only when Muslims are weak, with the obligation to resume hostilities when strength returns. It's not a peace agreement. It's not intended to become one. It's a tactical pause.
The difference between a hudna and a Western ceasefire isn't in the text. It's in the intention behind it.
Jihad, and this is the most loaded one. The term has multiple meanings, spiritual struggle, charitable effort, internal battle against sin. But in the context of the Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam framework, it does include armed struggle as a core component. It's not the only meaning, but it's not a mistranslation either.
Which brings us to the binary, Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam.
Classical jurisprudence divides the world into two categories, Dar al-Islam, the abode of submission, territories under Islamic rule. Dar al-Harb, the abode of war, everywhere else. And jihad is the mechanism to convert the latter into the former. This isn't fringe. Classical jurists like Ibn Taymiyyah endorsed it, and modern ones like Sayyid Qutb built their frameworks on it.
Here's the thesis. These aren't four separate concepts. They're a single strategic grammar. Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam provide the moral framework. The world is divided. Unification is the goal. Jihad is the engine. The permanent struggle to make that happen. Hunna is the tactical pause. When you're too weak to advance, you regroup. And Takia is the operational tool that lets you navigate the spaces in between without revealing your hand.
The West treats these as individual tactics. They lied, they broke the ceasefire, they're radicalized. But Iran and militant groups treat them as a system, with each piece enabling the others.
This is where we need the warning label. Acknowledging this strategic coherence doesn't mean all Muslims believe this. The majority reject this framework, but the minority who operationalize it, Iran's state apparatus, Hamas's military wing, have been extraordinarily effective precisely because they're working from a coherent playbook while their opponents treat each move as an isolated surprise.
The danger is either dismissing this as a conspiracy theory, which lets it work, or treating it as representative of Islam, which is bigoted. Both errors have real consequences.
Let's get into how Iran turned Takia from a survival tactic into a strategic weapon.
The Iranica article traces the origins back to the earliest Shia communities. The key Quranic verse is Surah al-Imran, verse 28, which permits believers to conceal their faith when under threat. But the classical jurist developed this far beyond simple concealment. It moved through stages. Initially, it was about hiding your Shia identity in public. But by the Safavid period, you start seeing jurists argue that Takia could extend to active misrepresentation in service of the community's interests. Not just hiding, but strategically misleading.
It goes from, I won't tell you I'm Shia to, I'll sign an agreement I don't intend to honor, because my intention is judged by the outcome I'm working toward, not by the words on the paper.
That's the evolved form, which is where the JCPOA becomes the perfect case study.
Walk me through it.
The 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran's negotiators repeatedly invoked the Supreme Leader's fatwa against nuclear weapons as a good faith signal. Khamenei had issued a formal religious edict declaring the production, stockpiling, and use of nuclear weapons as haram, forbidden. Western negotiators took this seriously as a binding constraint on Iran's intentions.
Then the 2026 strikes revealed undeclared enrichment sites.
So was the fatwa a lie? Iran says no. The fatwa was real and remains binding. Their argument is that weapons was narrowly defined. It covers actual bomb assembly, not enrichment capacity. Building centrifuges and stockpiling enriched uranium isn't building a weapon, so the fatwa wasn't violated.
This is the mechanism I find so hard to pin down. They're not saying we lied. They're saying the word weapons means something more specific than you assumed, and we let you assume the broader meaning because it served our strategic interests. That's not a lie in their framework. It's exploiting ambiguity in service of a permissible goal.
This is the core insight most Western analysis misses. Takia isn't about saying the opposite of the truth. It's about constructing a statement that is technically defensible while leading the listener to a false conclusion. The speaker's intent is what matters, and the intent is judged by the outcome. If enriching uranium to breakout capacity serves the goal of strengthening Dar al-Islam against Dar al-Harb, the fatwa that enabled it was not a deception. It was a strategic instrument.
Which makes verification basically impossible if you're only verifying stated intentions. You have to verify capabilities. The JCPOA failed because it trusted the fatwa rather than inspecting undeclared sites.
That's the lesson. Now let's look at Hudna, because the same pattern repeats. The classical jurist derived the temporary truce principle from the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Prophet Muhammad's truce with the Quraysh tribe in 628. It was signed for 10 years, but the Muslims broke it after 2 when they'd grown strong enough to take Mecca. The precedent is built into the founding narrative.
The idea that a truce is only valid while you're weak isn't some extremist innovation. It's mainstream classical jurisprudence.
Britannica confirms this. The 4 Sunni schools all addressed it, and while they differ on details, they agree on the core principle. A hudna is temporary by definition. Permanent peace with Dar al-Harb is not, in this framework, a coherent concept.
Because the framework defines the non-Muslim world as the abode of war. Peace with the abode of war is a contradiction in terms. You can have a cessation of hostilities. You can't have peace, because peace implies the war is over, and the war isn't over until Darul Harb becomes Darul Islam.
So when Hamas agrees to a ceasefire, and Western mediators call it a step toward peace, they're speaking completely different languages. Hamas is operating within a framework where the ceasefire is a phase of the war. The Western mediator is operating within a framework where the ceasefire is an alternative to war. Those are incompatible.
The evidence from 2021 through 2026 bears this out. Each ceasefire was followed by tunnel reconstruction within weeks, rocket manufacturing ramping up, command structures being rebuilt. The next round was always more intense because the pause had been used to accumulate capacity. Documented in Israeli and Egyptian intelligence assessments across multiple cycles.
Here's where the Takaya link becomes unavoidable. You can't execute a Hudna effectively without Takaya, because the ceasefire negotiations require a performance of good faith. The Hamas negotiators have to appear to be seeking a genuine resolution.
From their perspective, they are. A genuine resolution within their framework is a pause that enables the next phase of the struggle. The good faith is real. It's just defined differently. The deception isn't in the agreement text. It's in the gap between how they understand the word ceasefire and how the other side understands it.
That's why Western negotiators keep falling for this. They're not being out-negotiated on the details. They're being out-framed at the conceptual level. They treat ceasefires as endpoints. Within this framework, they're waypoints.
This is what makes the whole thing so difficult to counter. It's not cartoonish villainy. It's a coherent alternative worldview with its own internal logic and its own definitions of good faith, truth, and peace. If you don't understand the grammar, you're perpetually surprised.
Now here's where it gets interesting. These concepts don't operate in isolation. They form a system. Let me show you how.
This is the part I've been waiting for. Daniel's prompt is really about how they lock together.
Start with the umbrella. Jihad in the Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam framework isn't one tactic among many. It's the permanent condition. Classical jurists like Ibn Taymiyyah and modern ones like Sayyid Qutb both endorse the view that jihad is an obligation until the world is unified under Islamic rule. The disagreement isn't over the end goal. It's over means.
The binary makes jihad perpetual by definition. If the world is divided into the abode of war and the abode of submission, and your framework says the abode of war must eventually become the abode of submission, then the struggle never actually ends. There's no victory condition short of total transformation.
And that's what separates this from a conventional war, which has objectives and an endpoint. Any pause is just a phase, which is exactly where Hudna fits. It's the breathing room inside a permanent struggle. And Takiya is the grease that lets you navigate the pauses without giving away that you're still in the fight.
That's the system. But here's where Iran adds something genuinely distinctive. The Shia doctrine of Wilayat al-Faqihah, guardianship of the jurist, centralizes authority over all of these concepts in a single figure. The supreme leader can declare jihad, authorize Hudna, and interpret the bounds of Takiya. That's not how Sunni groups operate.
The operational difference is coordination at state scale. When Khamenei authorizes a negotiation, he's simultaneously managing the Takiya boundaries and the Hudna timeline. A decentralized Sunni group like ISIS doesn't have that. Different factions interpret Takiya differently. No single authority can declare a Hudna that the whole organization respects. The result is strategic fragmentation.
Iran can run all four concepts as an integrated state strategy, while Sunni militant groups tend to use them more like a grab bag of justifications.
And that's why Iran has been so much more effective at the long game. Look at the full timeline from 2015 to 2026. Takiya enabled the JCPOA negotiations. The fatwa's ambiguity created space to sign while pursuing breakout capacity. Hudna governed the inspection regime. Access was granted just enough to relieve pressure, but never enough to verify undeclared sites. Jihad provided the justification. Every centrifuge spun in service of strengthening Dar al-Islam against Dar al-Harb. And the Dar al-Harb binary made the whole thing morally coherent. Deception and truce. Breaking aren't shameful if the end goal is righteous.
That's the part that's hardest for a Western audience to process. In this framework, breaking a deal isn't a failure of character, it's a success of strategy.
Because the moral weight is on the outcome, not the process. If the outcome is expanding Dar al-Islam or defending it against Dar al-Harb, the intermediate steps, The deceptions, the broken truces, are sanctified by the destination. The means are judged by the end in a way that Western liberal frameworks explicitly reject.
Which is why the West keeps getting surprised. A Western negotiator sits down and thinks, we're both trying to reach a stable agreement. The Iranian negotiator sits down and thinks, this is a phase of the struggle, and my job is to secure the best position for the next phase. Those aren't compatible assumptions.
The JCPOA is the case study in why this blind spot is so costly. The entire agreement was structured around trusting Iran's stated intent, the fatwa. Verification was limited to declared sites. The possibility that the fatwa itself was a Takaya instrument wasn't factored into the enforcement mechanism. So when 2026 revealed the undeclared enrichment sites, it wasn't a violation of the agreement's terms in Iran's framework. It was a fulfillment of the strategy the agreement was always part of.
The West saw a violation. Iran saw the next phase.
That's the grammar problem in a nutshell. If you don't understand that Hudna isn't peace, that Takiya isn't lying in the Western sense, and that jihad isn't just a metaphor, you will consistently misinterpret what's happening. Not because you're naive, but because you're reading a different playbook than the other side is using.
This is where the Islamophobia trap gets really sharp. Everything we just described sounds like it was pulled from a conspiracy forum. Secret doctrines, permanent war, sanctioned deception. The language maps perfectly onto the worst anti-Muslim propaganda.
That's exactly why serious analysts sometimes shy away from this entire topic. But the problem is, these concepts are real. They're documented in mainstream Islamic jurisprudence, and they're operationalized by real state and non-state actors. Avoiding the topic doesn't make the strategy go away. It just means the people who do talk about it are often the worst possible messengers.
How do you talk about it without feeding the bigotry?
You keep two things true at once. One, this framework exists, it's coherent, and it explains a lot of strategic behavior that otherwise looks irrational or duplicitous. Two, the vast majority of Muslims don't subscribe to it, don't operationalize it, and would reject the idea that their faith reduces to these four concepts. Both statements are true. The error is dropping either one.
The minority who do operationalize it have been extraordinarily effective. Iran's nuclear program advanced through a decade of negotiations that were supposed to stop it. Hamas rebuilt its military capacity through multiple ceasefires that were supposed to end the conflict. This isn't luck. It's a strategic doctrine working as designed.
The West's response has been to treat each instance as a separate failure of diplomacy or intelligence. But if you see the system, you stop being surprised. You start expecting the Hudna to end when strength is rebuilt. You start reading the fatwa for what it doesn't say rather than what it implies. You structure verification around capabilities, not stated intentions.
Which is the actionable insight. The JCPOA didn't fail because Iran was uniquely deceptive. It failed because the agreement was built on a category error, treating a Hudna as a peace treaty and a Takiya instrument as a good faith commitment.
If this framework is real and operational, and the evidence says it is, what do we actually do about it?
First one seems obvious in retrospect. Stop negotiating against stated intentions and start verifying capabilities. The JCPOA trusted a fatwa. It should have trusted inspectors with access to every site.
That's not just about Iran. Any negotiation with an actor who operates within this framework needs to be structured around the assumption that words are instruments, not commitments. You build verification regimes that don't depend on the other side's good faith, because good faith in their framework means something different than it means in yours.
The hard part is that this sounds like bad faith negotiating on our side. Walking into a room assuming the other guy might be using Takiya feels paranoid.
It's not paranoia if they've demonstrated the pattern across decades and multiple negotiation cycles. It's pattern recognition. The alternative is being surprised again.
Ceasefire agreements need built-in verification and enforcement that account for Hudna dynamics. A pause in hostilities without inspection regimes is just rearmament time with a nicer name.
Hamas demonstrated this across every ceasefire cycle from 2021 through 2026. Tunnel reconstruction started within weeks. Rocket production ramped up. Command structures rebuilt. Each round was worse than the last because the pause was used as a logistics window.
What does a Hudna-proof ceasefire look like?
It includes real-time monitoring of military infrastructure, restrictions on dual-use materials, concrete for tunnels, chemicals for propellants, and enforcement mechanisms that trigger automatically when violations are detected, not when the next round of hostilities makes them undeniable. The key shift is treating the ceasefire as a monitored pause, not a diplomatic achievement.
For analysts and policymakers, learn the grammar. If you can't distinguish between a genuine peace negotiation and a hoodna, you'll be outmaneuvered every time.
The litmus test is whether the other side acknowledges the Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam binary as their operating framework. If they do, you're not in a peace process, you're in a hoodna. Iran's Wilayat al-Thaqi doctrine makes this explicit. The supreme leader's authority over Taqiyya, jihad, and hoodna is centralized and doctrinal, not improvised.
That's the thing. You don't need to guess. Iran publishes this stuff. The framework is not hidden. It's articulated in jurisprudential texts, in speeches, in the constitutional structure of the Islamic Republic itself. The blind spot isn't a lack of information. It's a refusal to take the information seriously.
Which leaves us with an uncomfortable question, one that doesn't have a good answer.
If the West adopted a similar framework, treating negotiations as phases of a longer struggle, using deception as a tool, viewing ceasefires as tactical pauses rather than endpoints, would that be realism or escalation?
I've been turning this over, and I don't know. On one hand, you could argue it's just acknowledging the game that's already being played. If one side is operating within a Hudna framework, and the other side is treating every ceasefire as a step toward peace, the second side is going to lose. Not because they're weaker, but because they're playing chess while the other side is playing something else entirely.
Matching the framework is just strategic parity. You're not escalating, you're catching up.
That's where it gets slippery. Because the moment you adopt the framework, the moment you start treating your own ceasefires as tactical pauses and your own negotiations as instruments rather than commitments, you've changed what you are. The Western liberal order is built on the idea that agreements mean something, that good faith is universal, that peace is the default destination. If you abandon that, even strategically, you've abandoned the thing you're supposedly defending.
This is the trap. If you don't adapt, you lose. If you do adapt, you become something you didn't want to be.
The other side knows this. Part of why this framework is so effective against Western powers is that it exploits a genuine moral commitment. The West actually does want peace. It actually does treat ceasefires as steps toward resolution. That's not weakness, it's a real value. But it creates a vulnerability that this doctrinal system is designed to exploit.
The question for the next decade isn't just about military capacity or nuclear breakout timelines. It's about whether Western strategy can figure out how to counter a framework that treats negotiations as a phase of war without becoming mirror images of the thing they're countering.
The clock is ticking. Iran's nuclear program has entered a post-breakout phase. Regional proxies are more sophisticated than they were a decade ago. The doctrinal toolkit we've been describing isn't theoretical. It's operational, it's documented, and it's being used right now. Understanding it isn't optional anymore. It's survival level.
What happens when both sides are playing this game?
I think that's the question that defines the next 10 years. And I don't think anyone has a good answer yet.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The oldest surviving mechanical clock in the Seychelles is a water-driven timepiece from the 9th century, carved from a single block of Takamaka wood, and its only surviving inscription reads, "The tide waits for no caliph."
The tide waits for no caliph.
That's gonna sit with me.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Send us your thoughts. show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close front.
from sloth, from man, from long. It holds my weird prongs. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.